place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and for Hurley's census, my reason for travel is I was retrieving a mystery box.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and for Hurley's census, the reason I'm traveling from Australia to Los Angeles is, I don't know if you heard, but the band Driveshaft is getting back together. That's the rumor I heard. One night only.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were approached by Hurley to fill in information about his census on the island, I would tell him that the reason why I was in Australia was that I was lost on an island in the Pacific Ocean, and then I was rescued and taken to Australia, and now I'm just flying back home to the United States, but I've become lost again, because that's the kind of luck I envision myself having.
Hurley would just shake his head and go like, man, I'm just like,
oh, man,
off.
That sucks, dude.
That's a tough life for here on the island. You've stumbled into The Storm, the podcast where we are rewatching Lost from season one and split the podcast into two different parts, depending on how you want to rewatch it. If this is your first time through ABC's Lost, that first started airing in 2004, and you're living back in 2004 and only want to talk about the events of the island up through episode 10, Raised by Another, then you could wade right into the calm in the first part of this podcast. Then, in the back half of this podcast, we enter what we call The Storm, where we get to talk about this episode in the context of all of Lost, including the ending and things about Claire, because it's a Claire episode
Claire. This
week for Raised by Another. That's like at the top of my notes is C-L-E-H.
Claire. Episode.
All right, before we get into Raised by Another, though, Joanna, do we have any reviews for this Lost Rewatch podcast?
We sure do have some reviews. Okay, how about this one? 5 stars. R. Simon, 99. I get lost. The best day of the week is when The Storm shows up in my iTunes. Lost is the first show I watched, obsessed over, read all the theories, had Lostpedia bookmarked on my computer, and literally postponed leaving for vacation so I could be home to watch the finale. 15 years after the premiere, I'm doing rewatch with my teenage son and it is even more fun second time around. Dave, Neil, and Joanna are great fun, and I love when they nerd out on small details and theories. I've been a fan of Joanna's other podcasts for a while now, and I'm so happy to follow her into The Storm. Thanks for sending me back to the island. I've heard from a number of people that they're watching with their kids right now, which is really like a fun thing about this rewatch. So that's really fun. And then this one's 5 stars. Kay White listens out on Lost, in on the trio. I have a complicated relationship with Lost. I understand the ending, and in many ways it's satisfying. I'm just frustrated by the lack of resolutions for some of the show's mysteries. So when one of my fave podcasts switched topics, I was sad. But I'm staying at the small council on Patreon. Love the bonus content and excited for the Far From Home pod. And miss the chemistry and insights from this incredible trio enough to revisit what was captivating, if a bit frustrating, TV. Thank you. Thanks to all three of you for the hours of companionship and entertainment. See you at the con. So we will see that person at Con of Thrones, which is next week or this week. If you're listening to this podcast, I've lost track of all time on the island. Thank you for your reviews. We really appreciate them. You can leave us a review on iTunes. It's extra, extra helpful if you leave us a review about Lost, because that helps people who are looking for us as a Lost podcast to find us. So thank you so much, everyone.
Yeah, we have a long and mysterious history that's now being buried by a jungle. Did there used to be dragons here? We don't know. We don't know anymore. It's all been blanked out of our minds. Neil, now that we're in full island mode, we found some signals from our listeners. For your segment, found signals.
We sure did, Dave. I'm happy to report. First, some house cleaning. As you may have heard, we have an email, hosts@stormpodcast.com. We also have a new website, stormpodcast.com, and Twitter, @stormpodcast. But don't forget, patreon.com/stormofspoilers lives on. You can get in on it. Great bonus content, all kinds of fun stuff, as Joanna just mentioned with one of those reviews. I have an email, because I've been searching for your Lost introduction stories, and this one ultimately made me happy. This is an email from Asa. I watched Lost when it originally aired, but never finished it. I don't remember exactly when I stopped, although I know it was after Michelle Rodriguez shows up. I stopped watching Lost for the same reason I stopped watching The Walking Dead. Both had an amazing premise, well executed in the first seasons. However, eventually the story became less about our heroes fighting the mystery or external forces, in this case the island, or in the case of The Walking Dead, zombies, and became more about fighting each other. I got tired of screaming at the TV, "If only you worked together, you could survive this." I'm interested in seeing if I lose interest in this rewatch or if I can overcome this perceived flaw. Anyway, I'm excited to be watching Lost again and love your commentary. I've always said if I ever got sick and went on extended bed rest, Lost would be my first priority to watch to the end. Now I don't have to wait until I'm sick. So I'm very glad that you don't have to be sick to watch this, Asa. Thank you.
Yeah, dodge the Rousseau disease requirement for the rewatch.
But I wonder if, you know, if knowing more about the show or knowing how it ends, or, you know, this is something that we talked about a lot with Game of Thrones, which is if you know the things that are coming, are they easier to either sort of take as this is just part of it, or are they less egregious? I think that it's interesting to me that even though I didn't have a super strong emotional reaction to the where Lost sort of went, people did, and I'm curious to see if those things change over the course of our rewatch. So that's one of the other things I'll be looking to hear from y'all, hosts@stormpodcast.com. You can send us emails and tell us if your perception of some of the storylines on Lost are changing as we go along. So that is my call to action this week.
Yes, sometimes that's like how we feel knowing spoilers about things.
Yeah.
Then revisiting it and being like, oh, that isn't how I remembered, could be better or worse. When you know the ending, I think you're allowed to pay more attention to the steps along the way. At least that's what we hope, running a Lost rewatch podcast, at the very least. Joanna, when did you stop watching The Walking Dead?
Haven't we talked about this?
On the Storm rewatch podcast?
I swear someone like just asked me this when Glenn died. Spoiler.
That's another beep spoiler.
I tapped out. Well, I had to cover it for a while for work, right? So I think I would have tapped out earlier. Here's what I'll say. I watched season one. I did not watch season two. I can't remember if I watched season three, but I think I looped back in for season four because I had to cover it. So then I was covering it. And then they did that whole like cliffhanger, and I watched the premiere the following, you know, they had the like, who did Negan kill? And then I watched the premiere, and then it was like, hey, exactly who the comic books told you would be, and why did we deal with all of this rigmarole and subterfuge? It's terrible. And I got disgusted and I gave up. So yeah.
Womp.
Well, it's dead. It is, no, it's a good comparison because it's another example of a show that sort of gets high on its own supply of like mystery or ability to cause sort of this. Like Game of Thrones at a certain point figured out that if they started lying to the audience off screen or omitting things, they would generate more buzz.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this like weirdly like abusive relationship with the audience where it's like, we can just lie to you and you'll want to see the next season more. Which I definitely think is true of The Walking Dead. Definitely think it's true of Game of Thrones. I don't know if I remember it being the same with Lost.
Well, like, they didn't need to because the online community wasn't the same. You know what I mean? So they had, oh, I did just watch something. Oh, I watched, I was watching a bunch of behind the scenes stuff, for Lost the other day on YouTube for some reason. And I think I can talk about this without spoiling anything.
I'm going to make a note here just in case. Go ahead.
Some actors or actresses who are on the show at the end of the series were interviewed about filming the end of the series, and they were given their scripts for the finale on red sheets of paper so that you couldn't photocopy red sheets of paper. Something about that, right? Like they're printed on red sheets of paper and then you can't like then photocopy red sheets of paper. It won't show up.
Yeah, they still do that,
On the photocopy machine. Okay, so they didn't usually do this, but they did this for the finale. And then they weren't given all of it. I watched a character who has an actor who has a large part to play in the finale live read the final script. It's very emotional to watch. But then it ended before the episode ended because they weren't given the final scene. So I don't know. I was like fascinated watching this because I was like, this is the beginning of, you know, and they like, I think, one of the actors had to install a lock on their mailbox because the scripts were delivered to their mailbox by like the postal service. Right. Basically the production company's like, you have to install this lock. Otherwise you have to come in and get your scripts. We won't mail them to you because someone will just steal it out of your mailbox. So put a lock on your mailbox. So that all seems fairly low stakes compared to like the Cloak and Dagger that wound up like happening with Walking Dead and Game of Thrones, in later seasons. But I was still like, okay, it's the beginning of it. Here it is. And I'm like, and I can't even imagine now Lost trying to do all the things it did in the final season and the fact that they filmed out in the open, for so much of it,
In the sight of all those non-existent drones.
Well, they were on the beach, like stuff happening on the beach.
I mean, that's more to your point, where if it happened now, like Drone City.
Yeah, Drone City. But I'm just saying, like, even then, since they were on the shore, someone could be out on the boat with like a telephoto lens or something like that. So, yeah.
Yes, that would be us.
What you're saying is that it would be impossible.
Yeah.
To do Lost again.
What I'm saying is that the internet has ruined fandom.
Mystery-based entertainment.
Except when Lost 2 reveals itself
at
the end of the first season of an unrelated television series.
It's funny. I was just reading this the statement that Robert Kirkman just put out about how the way in which he ended the comic book, The Walking Dead. Did you guys read this?
No.
He basically ended it. He just ended it, and he ended it by surprise, where like he killed off a main character. I feel like I'm trying to dodge spoilers for all kinds of properties. In the comic book, which is, you know, progressed far beyond where the show is, he killed off a main character in the penultimate issue and then ended it by surprise with like one day notice on the last issue. And he was saying in the statement that he had fake covers commissioned for like a few more issues to come, just to like throw people off the scent that he was ending it. And the reason he gave was, it's this long thing about how much he loves being surprised, how he hates when you're watching a TV show and you can track by the commercial breaks how close you are to the ending, or you can look at the scroll bar, you can look at your watch or whatever it is, and he likes being swept away by a story and just surprised by an ending. And this, I was reading the whole thing and I was just muttering like, it's about execution, bud. No, it's about execution, bud. So like, Kirkman would definitely disagree with us in our spoiler policy, but I just thought that was funny. I was just literally reading that today. So
Kirkman loves Deep Blue Sea. That that I'm not going to ask.
Beep.
Why add that spoiler? Yeah. Why do that? But that's interesting. I wonder if now that the comic book's over, can I go back and finish it? Because I got pretty far into the comic book before, much like the show, just living in misery. Wasn't something I wanted to do to myself. But let's instead go back to this pot boiler set on an island.
Can I really quickly say that I think some of the like weirder, more experimental stuff that Lost does in its later seasons, and I think it's okay for me to say that, I think is necessary to keep it from becoming The Walking Dead, because the reason one of the other reasons I tapped out on The Walking Dead is because it's just like so repetitive. There's only so much you can do to be like, it's a sociological experiment, man. Don't you get it? Different people have different ideas of how to lead and create a society under extreme circumstances. And I'm like, I do get it. I got it in season, like, whatever, and we're still going. So, I got Walking Dead fatigue because of that. And I think that if Lost had, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Lost breaks from the structure that our new watchers are probably already aware of in this first season, of like each person has an episode and then it teaches them a lesson and we learn who that person is and blah, blah, blah. If they kept doing that, but just like killing people off and adding new people to the mix, which is what The Walking Dead does, I would have gotten so much more. I would have gotten bored, you know, myself.
Yeah. I think the Lost benefits from, at some point, we're not anywhere close to there, but the creators did ask if they could end the series and eventually got the green light. So I think like a pivot towards an ending, whether or not that was like a satisfying ending for everything, really helped the series like refocus. Cause I could, you know, the first three seasons to me sort of blend together as a certain mix. And then the other ones are like the blank season or the blank season.
Right,
which are things I can't talk about, but I think the show is capable of
the ice cream cone season.
The ice cream cone season. Yeah, everybody remembers the ice cream cone season.
I'm really partial to the season on the moon.
Well,
oh yes, the moon season.
It's funny because when you talk about that structure, we were just doing for the Storm Patreon Slack book club this month. We read Watchmen because Damon Lindelof is doing a Watchmen TV series for HBO. And so I was sort of digging into news about Watchmen, and it got me super excited for it. But what's interesting is this structure, the season one structure, is something that Lindelof, with a slightly lighter touch, used in Leftovers. You would have character-centric episodes. This is the Carrie Coon episode. This is a Christopher Eccleston episode, blah, blah, blah. And then, I think it's, Tim Blake Nelson, who's in the new Watchmen series, gave an interview where he basically said that they're doing the same thing for Watchmen, that you'll have a Tim Blake Nelson-centric episode and then a someone else-centric episode. So I just love that that's like a structure that Lindelof can't quit. He's like, sorry, it's too good. I got to keep going back. So
if you keep bringing gold out of the river, don't move.
Exactly. So
all right. Gold padding references aside, which are super relevant to today's youth. Neo, what happened this week in episode 10 of Lost, Raised by Another?
Well, Dave, episode 10, as you mentioned, directed by Marita Grabiak. This is the part where I read names that I've never really read out loud before. Actually, the first episode directed by a woman of Lost, written by Lynn E. Litt. Also, first episode written by a woman. And you can see that there are some thematic reasons for that, as you might imagine, but also good stuff. Lost only took you 10 episodes, which is pretty good for 2004. Anyway, here's what happened in this episode. On the island, it begins with Claire having a bad dream. And then, not long after, Claire has another bad dream. After which, Jack tries to give her some Xanax. But that doesn't go very well. Hurley begins compiling the island's first census. And, of course, Locke makes it weird when asked questions. Also leaves out the part where he was in a wheelchair before, by the way. Claire, obviously not happy about Jack trying to drug her, sets off through the jungle, for that walk, which is hard to say how long it takes to get from the caves to the jungle, but in this episode, it's most of the episode. Later on the beach, as we follow Hurley, we learn that Boone is a liberal and that the manifest from the plane still exists. All Hurley has to do is sweet talk Sawyer, which goes far easier than expected because Hurley is so damn charming that even Sawyer can't be a dick about it. On their walk back, Charlie does his best to keep Claire calm, remembering that Jack told him that too much stress could lead to an early birth. And he eventually talks her back into moving to the caves, which makes everything fine, as you might imagine. A little bit later, Saeed returns, tells everyone that they're not alone on the island, which, fun. In flashbacks this week, we learn that Claire found out that she was pregnant, and then her... I'm going to just call him the dipshit boyfriend. He talks her into making it work between the two of them in a way that I don't think I ever really bought, if we're being honest. Claire then goes to a psychic who freaks out, which is weird. Later, we see Claire's dipshit boyfriend bail on her because everyone saw that one coming. Well, a lot of people saw that one coming.
When am I going to have time for my painting, Neil?
Everyone needs to get back to their art. So she returns to the psychic, which seems like a very rational idea, and it gets far more weird. She's told by this psychic, what's his name?
Malkin.
She is told that danger surrounds her baby and that she must be the one to raise him. Now you're starting to see why this episode's called Raised by Another.
I'm sorry, did you say Raised by an Other?
Raised by Another. Yeah. Claire then tries to give her baby to a lovely couple from Melbourne, but then her pen doesn't work because the universe doesn't want her to give up her baby. So she jumps on a flight to Los Angeles and lives happily ever, mostly. Well, not really. The whole episode ends with Hurley figuring out that Ethan wasn't on the plane, man. He's also currently in the jungle giving Claire and Charlie a very dark look.
One of those, what's the real family last names look?
Mapother?
Oh, Mapother, yeah.
Yeah, one of those.
Classic Mapother.
Yeah. One of those hard stares that people pay real acting money for. All right.
So that's what happens in this, what is otherwise a very talky episode of Lost. It's a very walk and talky sort of thing.
It is, and I think it skirts being one of our stereotypical backstories, because it doesn't swing, I think, for the fences of Walkabout, which I think brought me down a little bit on the Sawyer monologue at the end of Confidence Man, but manages to, you know, weave a little bit of mystery into Claire's otherwise more stereotypical backstory. And I think that's just enough mystery and dread to bounce back and forth to our island storyline and not necessarily feel like I'm having a drag on my Claire backstory, which is, like Neil was pointing out, as soon as you see Thomas and he says, I think I can make this work, I'm a painter, you're like, I basically know where this is going. And it isn't until, you know, psychic freaks out that I really have a hook into Claire's backstory. But maybe that's just me spending a lot of time watching television about pregnant people. Joanna, what did you think about our first Claire episode?
Claire, I'm okay with it. Claire's not my favorite character. This isn't the most compelling episode for me. But there's enough other, like, on-island stuff going on that is kind of interesting to me. But I don't know. I have trouble latching onto Claire as someone to, like, deeply root for. Is this where we talk about peanut butter?
I suppose that the rabble has spoken and risen to a loud enough point. Let's talk about peanut butter.
2 weeks ago, we did an episode wherein Charlie brings Claire an empty jar. He dupes a pregnant lady, saying that he has peanut butter, when in fact he only has an empty jar in his grubby fingers with which to scoop air into his mouth. It's actually...
And then stick his grubby, dirty fingers into his own mouth, which is the most sanitary thing to do while you're on an island.
I actually think it's like a fairly sweet moment, but Claire has this line in the episode where she's like, I really want peanut butter. I'm the only Australian who likes peanut butter. And we were like, I guess Australians don't like peanut butter.
You gotta say it like she does, a peanut butter.
Oh yeah, you nailed it. We had a lot of pushback from our listeners for taking Claire's word on this one. Apparently Australians love peanut butter. In fact, I got an email today from an Australian in a grocery store who took a photo.
We are banned from the country.
An Australian listener in a grocery store took a photo of the peanut butter section and sent it to me as proof of how much, and it's a lot of peanut butter. It's more peanut butter than they have at my local market. So Australians really like peanut butter, apparently. And then this also kicked off like a huge, like our listeners who are in our Patreon Slack have not stopped talking about peanut butter for like a week. So, you know, the peanut butter debate, it rages on. People have a lot of peanut butter opinions, but
Would you say that it's mostly pro peanut butter, or is there like a large anti peanut butter contingent?
Some people have peanut allergies. So
that's fair.
You know,
I can see how you'd be against peanut butter if it would kill you.
If you have a peanut allergy, that's fine. It just looks like a jar of anaphylaxis. Did I ever tell you about the fact that my friend Lindsay wanted to start a food truck with me that sells
called Jar of Anaphylaxis?
No, a food truck that only sells shellfish called Vanaphylaxis. All right.
I wasn't that far off.
I know.
Sorry to step on your joke. I was like, oh, there's a good joke at that.
I know.
You there cut me off before I could make that the Jar of Anaphylaxis was my band name. And then just rolled over me with the Vanaphylaxis.
Vanaphylaxis.
Jar of Anaphylaxis. They're opening for Drive Shaft.
In LA. That's what I heard. Anyway, peanut butter. Australians love it. So.
Yep.
Tommy Kangaroo down, I apologize.
Apparently the debate is going to live on to I suspect we might have to check back in on the Peanut Butter Wars next Claire episode, but we'll see how soon that will be. So
I'm sorry, have you been thrown by the peanut butter talk?
No, I'm trying.
Are your thoughts
to talk
stuck
about
to the roof of your mouth?
I want to talk about Claire's dreams, but be very careful not to add more beeping to my own life post-production life. We start on this is what an eye-opening episode in the sense that we start on an eye, something that Lost likes to do. But we do get some Claire dream sequence to start off that involves a bloody crib, basically to throw us off the scent later on when she claims to have been attacked in the night, and we, having seen it through the perspective of I think the camera's an unreliable narrator anytime you've already seen a dream sequence, is sort of presented in a way that it could be both ways, and ends up a rift between Jack and Claire. It's interesting in the rewatch how I think like the cinematography is on the side of her second experience being a dream. Well, I think the script and the characters are definitely on the side of it being real, with the exception of Jack, or maybe Kate's just having too much fun sinking into the beach and being genuinely like melancholy to not side with Claire. But what did you guys make of our dream sequences?
Some of it is shot a little like cheesily, I think. A little like I don't know. It doesn't seem like the style of Lost. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems more like a horror film.
Yeah. Whoa. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a little fast. Also, I mean, I think it's interesting that Jack is the one who is, you know, so sure that something weird isn't happening to Claire. Because we've also seen him kind of go through that himself already. We saw him chasing his father through the jungle. So Jack's conclusion is that she's under a lot of stress. She's hallucinating. But there has to be some part of Jack, you would think, that is like, wait, but the island is showing us weird stuff. Or the island at least showed me some weird stuff. So it's more of this, like, Jack not believing what is happening around him in light of, you know, even with only 10 episodes in, we have pretty significant evidence that the island or some force on the island is communicating with people, you know, in some way.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Like, that's how I always read it for Claire, was whether it's a dream, whether it's real, it's this continuation of the island trying to send messages, or the island awakening a power inside of people on the island that allows them to see or anticipate what's going to happen, or what could happen, you know?
So you're pro, in this hour of Lost television, people can see the future. Does that also extend to flashback territory? Is Malkin full of shit?
That's a really great question. By the end of this episode, and I think we'll probably talk more about this in the storm, but it's like, I don't know, you kind of believe that he knows, or that he knew, or that what he saw had something to do with the crash. Like, yeah, that's definitely, like, by the end of this episode, I was pretty sold that the psychic Malkin, not only did he know something bad was going to happen, but he also, he knew that there was something about that flight that he had to get her on. So we don't really know what he saw, but, it seems very on purpose, obviously.
I guess I'm interested.
It's really hard to talk about this in a calm way, I think.
I want to try to put yourself in that position. I want to ask you a question. Is this the first episode of Lost where by the end of the episode, your conclusion is that, like, this magical plane exists? Because I think Neil's right. We see some stuff in dreams that is like heavy on symbolism. And then the episode is written in a way where we're supposed to be on Claire's side when she thinks Malkin knew the plane riding. So is this the writer's room finally getting to, like, the magic part of the island, but, like, in a definitive way, where previously up to now, we haven't seen anything for sure. Locke maybe has, but we haven't as an audience seen anything that makes this island magic.
Haven't we seen, like, a giant monster of some kind put a pilot in a tree? Like, isn't that when we know that the island has something going on?
Well, I think
it could be like King Kong going on, not like
that's still magic. I don't know. Like,
I think
that is nature. I have seen so many movies explain to me how that is nature. Go ahead, Neil. Sorry.
I think that the show that the show has been telling us for 10 episodes, for the most part of 10 episodes, that that there's some magical power to the island. This is the first episode where I feel like it comes into focus, for me at least, that there's something special about the people on that, like specifically special about the people on that flight. This episode, I think, starts to really sell the destiny of Flight 815, where it's like Claire's the first person that we are being told by the show had to be on that flight for a specific reason. We don't know what the reason is, because that, for all we know, the Australian psychic with the not great accent, but okay.
Wait.
Could be full of it.
Now is the time for a new segment that I came up with just a, like 10 minutes ago. Are you ready?
Go for it.
It's called Is This Actor Australian? And we have two candidates in this episode. Okay. Nick Jameson is the actor who plays Richard Malkin, the psychic. Mm-hmm. Is he Australian? Dave?
No.
Neil?
I'm also going with no, but yeah. I'm ready to be wrong, I guess.
That's a hard no. He's from Missouri. Okay. Kira O'Donnell is the actor who plays Thomas, Claire's deadbeat boyfriend.
I'm reasonably
is
sure he's...
Is he Australian? Neil?
Yes.
Dave?
No.
I think you are both kind of right. He was born in Australia, lived there till he was 8, and then he moved to the
so
U.S.
So he had the thing on his resume headshot that got him through the first door. And then he just performed his way into the role of Thomas the Artist.
And his father's Australian. It's sort of like Pedro Pascal, his Oberyn Martell accent, where he claims he's just doing his dad's accent. You know what I mean? It's like one of those things, like you hear Pedro Pascal talk and you're like, oh, that guy's definitely not.
He's from California.
Yeah, exactly. But like his accent sounds pretty consistent, and that's because he's just doing an impression of his dad. And that's probably what the actor who played Thomas was doing, was like an impression of his dad. Anyway, there you go. That's the latest game of Is This Actor Australian?
Is This Actor Australian? I feel like we played that before with a Jack episode, but now we have it has a title and it will definitely return.
It will return.
It's funny that the answer is always some kind of no.
Like, usually.
The guy who was born in Australia, it's still kind of no.
Yeah. Someone sent us a text to circle back to the peanut butter. I regret to inform you, we're circling back to the peanut butter. Somebody sent me a text exchange where they texted an Australian friend of their, you know, go ahead, text an Australian when you're watching Lost. And they were like, hey, do Australians not like peanut butter? And their friend was like, no, we do. And they're like, oh, sorry, I was watching Lost. And Claire says she doesn't. And they were like, oh, LOL, worst written Australian character of all time. So apparently Claire has that reputation for being.
Wow.
She just
not,
has all the wrong opinions about
not representative
everything.
Of her country.
I wonder if we're going to find out that there's more to that or if it's just peanut butter related.
I can't wait. Let's keep track of Claire opinions going forward. All right.
It'll give us something to do during Claire episodes. All right. Otherwise, on the island, we have Hurley taking a census, which is good, except... Oh, wait. I'm going to bleep that.
Guys, recently I was preparing to go on a trip across the country to a place called Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And I was at my local salon seeing my stylist. I have a stylist. And I saw on the counter a new product has moved in. It's called Hims. And I was like, hey, I recognize that name. Hims.
ForHims.com, if you're unaware and haven't heard us talk about it before, one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness for men. You know, if you are starting to see your hairline recede, if you've got other concerns you want to take care of, ForHims.com is a nice, discreet way to do so. 66% of men lose their hair by 35, and, you know, it starts going before you notice. That's how hair loss works. You don't notice it's going, and then all of a sudden you look in the mirror and you're like, oh my gosh, hello, bald spot. So just be on the lookout and maybe start early with ForHims.com.
ForHims, everybody, is how you remember to go to ForHims.com. There's no snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements for your hair loss, sexual wellness, and men's skincare. It's so easy. You just answer a few quick questions. A doctor will review and can prescribe you products that will be shipped directly to your door. That's ForHims.com. You can order now. Our listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See the website for full details and safety information. This would cost hundreds if you were to go to a doctor or a pharmacy. Go to ForHims.com/storm. That's ForHims.com/storm. ForHims.com/storm. For Hims, everybody.
Oh, man. I can confirm that going to a doctor and a pharmacy can be hundreds of dollars.
Skip it. ForHims.com/store. So Hurley is creating a census and is coming up with names and realizes that a certain Ethan, who we met last episode, is not on the manifest, which we've been with the manifest before. Claire used it to do a memorial service, crossed off the names, somehow ended up back with Sawyer because he's pack ratting, and then the pack rat gives it over to Hurley with the nickname Joanna. What's our Sawyer nickname for this episode?
It is Stay Puffed, which is a reference to the film Ghostbusters.
It's a movie starring four women who bust ghosts in New York.
Yes.
Yes.
We talked about this off air. I've sort of like talked about Hurley and like fat people representation on Lost before, and I think that like he has a good deal of dignity. There's like something like for some reason, and for some reason when Sawyer calls Hurley Jabba, I get mad, and when he calls him Stay Puffed, I don't get mad. And I don't.
Is it because one of them's cuddly?
Maybe. Like, yeah, it's just like one of them is like. As Neil pointed out off air in the movie Ghostbusters, Stay Puffed is like the manifestation of the most lovely and wonderful icon that this person could think of. And I'm like, that is Hurley, you know, so I don't know. I'm still grappling with my feelings about Sawyer and his nicknames. At least this one is not racial as far as I know. So, progress? Question mark?
Hey, yeah.
Not bad progress for 2004.
We need to learn a little bit more about Hurley, and that his full name is Hugo Reyes, and yeah. They tease the mystery of how he gets his nickname. Maybe to be continued, who knows? Elsewhere on the island, Jack is, like, as we were outlining sort of before, hunting down this problem thing for Claire, but I want to underline it because Jack might be at his most comfortable time on the island so far in this episode. Post-golfing, pre-everything that's about to go down, because next episode's a Jack episode, so he's going to have at least some mental strife coming up, which puts him in an interesting position because he has to be the doubting Thomas to Claire's vision just in time for Saeed to stumble in and shatter his worldview about the status quo on the island. Jack! Right or wrong in this episode, Neil?
Well, I think he proves to be right in a medical sense. Like, he is right that Claire getting all stressed out is not helping. And we see that sort of very vividly toward the end of the episode when Charlie has to calm her down. So he's right in a medical sense. You know, it's just, he doesn't know he's wrong about the other stuff. Like, he doesn't know he's, like, because Jack operates under this, throughout this episode, this idea that they are alone on the island, like, that there isn't somebody out there trying to hurt Claire. It's just the stress that, you know, it's the same stress-induced hallucinations that he had that, I guess, at this point he's written off as just hallucinations. So, yeah, I think he's medically correct, but he doesn't really know that he's wrong about the other thing until Saeed rolls back into town.
Joanna, how helpful is Saeed in his little bursts of whatever he could get out, knowing just what you know from this episode and maybe next episode?
He's very sexy. Wait, was that your question?
Yeah, yes. Well, I mean, sexy and helpful could be the same thing.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he is helpful in making everyone freak out, because that's like the last thing they wanted to hear when he came back was, we're not alone on this island. So, cool. Cool. Everyone's nervous now.
Hopefully they have some time to rush to the beach and head off Ethan. Who's cornered Claire and Charlie. Did not go to get Jack at the caves.
Yeah, I think Jack would have preferred Saeed save that and maybe bury the lead a little bit. Like, save that for a moment while we're not standing in front of everyone who's going to panic about this.
That's Jack always wanting to control the flow.
Classic Jack.
Control the flow of information, man.
Yeah, Jack is the one with the Patriot Act.
So true.
Does anybody remember? Do we even have like? That feels like such a 2004 thing that we would have to explain it to people.
Is it time for another round of what's the most 2004 thing about this episode?
It seems like we're getting towards the interview, so let's play. What's the most 2004 thing about this episode?
Oh, I have something else to say before the interview, but I'm going to do this first before we do what's the most 2004 thing about this episode. And it's to mention this idea of threes, because we got this before when we had, I mean, you mentioned Doubting Thomas already, Dave, but right, like Claire goes to sign the adoption papers and then her pen doesn't work and then her pen doesn't work. And then on the third time, she's like, never mind. Right. And it makes me think of Charlie talking about, you know, his, or Charlie having asked for his drugs three times. All right. So, I was actually reading a back to the Watchmen thing, right? I was reading, this letter that Lindelof posted on his, Instagram May 2018 about why he was doing Watchmen and why, people, you know, might be mad at him. It's a really good letter. It's such a good letter. May 22nd, 2018, Damon Lindelof's Instagram. Go read this letter. It's so good. And he writes, I'm 43 now and I'm thinking about something I read about Orthodox Judaism. While most religions are cultivated by evangelizing and conversion, Orthodox Judaism doesn't solicit. If someone from another faith wishes to become an Orthodox Jew, they are rejected. If they are stubborn enough to ask again, they are denied even more harshly. But should they have the audacity to ask a third time, the door cracks open. And if they're willing to invest an immense amount of time and effort and sacrifice and faith, they are embraced into the fold. Why am I thinking about this? I've said no to Watchmen twice now. This makes me Orthodox Judaism. I cracked the door. Now I'm a hypocrite too. Anyway, so just this idea. I mean, like, this is the thing about Lindelof is he gets, like, stuck on certain ideas. We already talked about this in the podcast. He gets stuck in certain ideas, and he is fascinated by religions, as anyone who's seen The Leftovers could tell you. And so I have to wonder if this idea of, like, threes and religious and faith and all this sort of stuff is something that's on Lindelof's minds and maybe something to watch for going forward. So
I hope so, because when Locke did it, on that episode said I was uncomfortable with it because three isn't like a lost thing as far as I know. So I'd like to be proven wrong through rewatch and find a whole bunch of good reasons to have threes. Cause otherwise, like they do a lot of different, numerical based plot things anyway, or whatever they're gonna be called.
Okay, let's get you out of the calm so you can talk more freely, but first it is time to vote on the most 2004 thing about this episode. Is it Boone's line, maybe we're not cool, you setting up your own little Patriot Act, man? Is it Claire's deadbeat boyfriend Thomas has some like fly accessories, and by fly I mean he's got a leather cuff watch on? Did either of you ever wear leather cuffs in your lives?
No.
Okay.
I can't say for sure certain I haven't worn some leather cuffs.
Yeah, I've worn a cuff or two in my day. Anyway, he's got a leather cuff watch on one wrist and then just like a plain ass cuff on the other wrist, and then he's got a string necklace. So like Thomas's whole, like, all of his accoutrement. So Thomas's look, Boone's Patriot Act line, Sawyer wears these orange lens daisy sunglasses with like, daisies or sunflowers on the frames, an iconic Sawyer look, that he obviously like fished. They're like probably some small child sunglasses that he fished out of luggage. So they look great. Those are my three things. Sawyer's glasses, Boone's Patriot Act line, Thomas's accessories.
Sawyer's glasses that he probably took from a dead kid.
Wow. Rough stuff.
Wow. Talk about the dead kids of Lost often enough.
It's true. Okay. Let us start with, Neil. Neil, what's the most 2004 thing about this episode?
I'm going for the Patriot Act. Also for Shannon's, he's a liberal line.
Well, I mean, Shannon, this is the episode, I guess, we find out where that Shannon is a Republican.
She's a young Republican.
Follow-up question. Do you think Shannon would have voted for Trump? I think she would have.
Yes.
Yep.
Me too. I think Shannon would have got woke by 2016.
Maybe, but do you... Okay, never mind.
Oops. She may have not voted.
Almost said something. Cool. Yeah, Shannon may not have voted at all. That's a fair point. And then Boone was definitely, I think, a Bernie bro. Okay.
Well, but it's all part of the Boone as this like crusader. You know, I think he's been called Captain America once already. Like he is the liberal crusader of the group.
Someone in our
the social justice warrior before that was a thing.
Someone in our Patreon Slack called Boone the like off-brand Diet Cola version of Jack. And I was like, yeah.
He's Diet Jack.
Diet Jack.
Diet Jack.
Dave, what's the most 2004 thing about this episode?
I'm taking Thomas's things that I definitely owned in that time period.
Yeah.
That's my choice.
I'm not saying I didn't think about wearing a cuff at some point. I'm just positive I never did it.
I think my junior year of high school, I wore a hemp necklace with a black stone at the center, like, the entire calendar year.
Oh yeah, I knew how to make those hemp necklaces. I taught myself how to do that. So, there you go. I could have hooked you up. Anyway, this has been another edition of What's the Most 2004 Thing About Lost.
Ooh, I did wear a pair of Oakley sunglasses once. That was a look.
Ooh, I had like a wraparound pair that were sort of like orangey. Mm-hmm. Oh, awful, very bad.
All my fashion decisions in high school were bad. I put some pictures in the Slack and people could confirm this. But you know, they were unique and they were me. And that's the important thing. Joanna, who are we talking to this week?
We actually have with us to talk about on-screen psychics and mediums. We have a medium herself, Amy the Medium. Let's go to that interview. So I am extremely lucky today to get to speak with Amy the Medium. Amy, you are a graduate of USC in the area of cinema and television. You worked at Disney, you worked at Warner Brothers. You've also spent 9 years practicing mediumship, psychic readings. So you are the and you're a Lost watcher. So you're the perfect person to talk to about this episode, Raised by Another. Amy, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So, do you want to talk about, how personally offended you are by this depiction of a psychic?
We can start with that.
All right. Let's start with my pal Malkin in this episode. So, he does some things, you know, as you know, this podcast is spoiler free. So we're not going to talk about like, if we learn more about Malkin in other episodes or whatever, we're just going to keep it confined to this episode. And confined to this episode, what do you think of Malkin's behavior? Would you ever harass someone who came to you? I'm sorry, I used the word harass. That's leading the witness. Would you ever repeatedly call someone who came to see you in order to insist they do something with their lives?
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, oh my gosh, this man is harassing her, and I have no idea why, because that is not something that any professional psychic or medium would ever do. he crosses, like, more than one boundary, not least of which calling her in the middle of the night, clearly for the umpteenth time.
You don't keep those hours?
No, okay. No, not so much. Also, I don't typically, this might sound harsh, but like if you're not sitting with me in a reading, I don't think about you. So it's not meant to sound mean, but like I work when I work and then I turn it off when I'm done. So I think this goes beyond his ability, which I will say, you know, when they first introduce him in the episode, besides the weird eye closing and holding of the hands, he's kind of working the way that you would expect a psychic to work, but then it goes a little overboard. And so I would say he might have some personality issues that need to be addressed.
So what is he doing correctly in terms of his practice here?
So basically, when she sits down, I mean, the first thing that he kind of says to her is, when did you find out? Which is, when you're doing a psychic reading, like, that's what you're doing, is you're tapping into that person's energy that's sitting across from you, and you're able to just get information from their lives. You're not leading the witness necessarily. You're making statements of like, oh, I know this to be true. Granted, he does say it in the form of a question, but he does pick up the fact that, oh, she is with child. So that part is pretty accurate. But, you know, we don't have to work with our eyes closed. We don't have to hold hands. Some people do. I don't know why, but it's a personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quickly after that that it goes a little out of control when he starts to freak out.
Have you, well, let me ask you this, and I don't know if you can share this, if there's some sort of, like, client medium, like, confidentiality thing, but I'm just curious if you can talk broadly, like, if you were doing a reading for someone.
Yeah.
And you picked up on something that was, like, alarming or,
yes,
or, you know, unnerving. How do you, as a professional medium, how do you react to something like that?
There's a couple different ways. First thing is, before anybody sits down with me, I will ask them, are there any topics that are off limits? So they can tell me up front if something comes up, if I pick up on something that they don't want to know about, like if miraculously I know when they're going to die, that's never happened, but say it does, they can say, I don't want to know when I'm going to die. So then I will not mention that if it's information I receive. Other ways are, sometimes I'm given information that the spirit world will literally tell me, we're giving you this information so that you can deliver this message to this person, but don't tell them what we're telling you, which sounds kind of like I'm keeping secrets, but it's more just I need a bigger picture to help them inform a decision that they might want to make. But I never lead or guide anybody into making choices for them. It's all about free will. So you're going to make the choice you want for yourself. And then there's other times where, like, if I get something that might be alarming, I will just, in the process of the reading, say, okay, well, I'm picking up on something. I'm not sure if I should say this or not. Usually the client at that point is like, oh, just say it. Cause chances are they already know what's going to come out of your mouth. They already have an idea.
Something. So, you know, you and I have been friends for a long time, and so we, mm-hmm, you know, the things on which we the things we both believe in and the things we don't believe in, and that has not impacted our friendship. But I have had I don't know, readings from you, even though, like, I'm a deeply skeptical person, but I've had readings from you that I talk about it all the time to other people. I don't know if you know this, that I do this, but, like, I talk about it all the time to other people because it's like beautiful therapy. And part of it is, you know, part of it is because we know each other. And so, like, you know, some things about me already. And I'm sure that that's helpful, even, you know, no matter what, that can be helpful to have, like, insight into a person already when you're going to do a reading for them. But it's just, like, this beautiful experience, like, cause you've read, like, Tarot for me before, and it's just beautiful, like, mm-hmm, guided conversation. Do you know what I mean? I love
yeah,
doing that with you, even if I don't necessarily sort of quote unquote believe everything, because it's like a beautiful structured way for us to have a conversation about something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's interesting, too, because when you're doing, when you're sitting with someone, and it's funny that you say it's probably nice to have some background knowledge. It's actually better for me if I don't know anything about you.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, just because my own personal opinions can get in the way if I know too much about a person. But I've worked really hard so that, you know, if I am reading for friends, I try to put my personal stuff to the side so that I can get, like, a clear message through. But, yeah, it's... Usually every time I'm doing a reading, especially if it's a psychic reading, all I'm doing is picking up information that's already in your aura. It's in your energy. It's in your thoughts. It's in your emotions. And all I'm doing is helping to bring clarity to it. So a lot of times when people come with a question, they probably already know their own answer. They're just sort of doubting it, and they want, you know, someone to give them more insight or more information. And so, yeah, a lot of times the conversation can seem fairly therapeutic, just because it's somebody sitting across from you who can fundamentally understand what you're going through without having to know all the details, and can sympathize and empathize and help you work through it.
Yeah. So how therapeutic do you feel like this session that we see in this episode of Lost is? I mean, like, well, I'll say this. Like, if I were Claire and I were, you know, quite young and pregnant and, like, you know, unsure of my partner, these various factors that are going on in Claire's life, and I needed to decide sort of what I want to do going forward, I would imagine that maybe if I have an answer already in my head of, like, I feel like I should be the one to raise my baby, or I'm not ready to raise my baby, whatever, you know, whatever the options are here,
right,
it would be therapeutic to talk to someone who is able to just, yeah, provide me with that clarity of, like, okay, you're feeling guilt around it, but you know that this is what you really sort of want, and I can tell that this is what you really want. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That would be a great way to approach it. Unfortunately, that's not what he does.
Poor Claire. yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, after she sees him the first time and he completely freaks out and basically kicks her out, at that point, because I do the same thing, I'm like, wow, if that was me, what would I do? I would never go back to him. Right. And I think that's, like, her first mistake is she goes back to see him. There are plenty of psychics out there. Find someone else. But also, he doesn't go into her decisions at all. You know, at one point he says, oh, you have to be the one to raise this baby. And she's like, well, I've already decided I'm not going to. He should already know that that's how she's feeling. And if he were good at his job, he would say, okay, I know that you're feeling this way, but consider what it would be like if you did it, you know, if you raised this child yourself. It's a much softer way than trying to scare her
right
into doing what you want her to do, or manipulate her into the decisions that you feel are right.
So when you see something like this, because, you know, you see mediums and psychics a lot in film and television, to a varying degree, like a whole, they run the whole gamut of, I would say, positive representation to, you know, complete snake oil salesman or whatever. When you see, right. When you see something like this episode, what does it make you feel like the writers think about the practice of mediumship? Because Lost is like a kind of, it's a spiritual show, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's not afraid of spiritual ideas and this idea of like visions or prophetic dreams or all sorts of stuff
right.
That's in this episode. So, like, what do you feel like off this episode alone, the show's attitude towards this profession, or this concept is?
So towards the end of the episode, Charlie says to Claire, oh, I believe some people have the gift. And he says it in a way that's really genuine. He's like, I truly believe some people do. And when he said that, I thought that's the writer's voice coming through. You know, granted, he's the character trying to console her at the time.
Right.
But my perspective was this whole scenario wouldn't even have happened if the writers weren't open to it. So I definitely think that, because, like you say, it is a spiritual show and it has a lot of those elements in it, that this is just a component and aspect they wanted to explore. I will say, though, that, like most people who have never been to a psychic or don't go to see them all the time, wouldn't necessarily know the range of what you can get. So, yeah, like, there are the snake oil people who I would say, please stay away from them. But then you have people who are just like, you know, working everyday jobs who happen to have the ability, who give good readings. And so you have the whole spectrum. And I don't know if they necessarily decided to go down the path of doing all that research
right.
when they created this character. Granted, I do believe that the character is also used as a device. Because like I said, there are elements of his character that I'm like, okay, they're getting some things right. And then there's a lot of elements that are just completely wrong. But I feel like those elements are really there to push the story forward. And you're right. It is what Hollywood does with anybody in this sort of spiritual profession. They tend to continue to perpetuate that stereotype, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for you, it must be frustrating because you're fighting against sort of this perception that film and TV keeps putting out in the world of, like, what your gift is, you know, and you're like, that's not what I do. I don't call poor, pregnant, confused girls in the middle of the night to insist they get on airplanes or whatever. What do you feel like is one of the worst depictions of a psychic or a medium that you've seen in pop culture?
Oh, wow, the worst? Okay, here, it's funny because my example of the worst used to be one of my favorites, which is Jennifer Love Hewitt in the Ghost Whisperer TV show.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you ever saw that, but terrible.
Oh, okay. Wait, so how did that go from your one of your favorites to worst?
It was one of my favorites before I did a whole lot of training to actually, like, understand and learn my ability. So when I watched it, I was like, oh, she's so compassionate and she's dealing with so many crazy things. But then, you know, having explored it with myself to understand what's happening, I'm like, oh, all they're doing in that show is just perpetuating that fear that, like, spirits are scary. And granted, she has the ability to see them, but she's terrified in every single episode. And then she's just far too nosy as well, just getting involved with people's lives without asking them, without getting permission, without them approaching her. So that's an example of one of my least favorites.
Do you have a favorite then?
I do have a favorite, which is equally as silly, Whoopi Goldberg in the movie Ghost.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that. Okay, all right. Tell me why.
Because she actually gives
Oscar-winning performance in Ghost. Right. Thank you very much.
Right? Yeah. She actually gives a really honest representation of what it's like to have the ability, where, like, she's got this spirit that she can't see, she can hear him, who's constantly chattering at her, and she's like, what do you want me to do about this? Like, I got my life going on. I don't want to get involved with this, but she ends up doing it. And, you know, especially the scene where she channels him, which not all psychics and mediums channel, FYI. But when she does that and she brings all that healing through for Demi Moore's character, that is one of the, like, most, I would say, as close as you could get to accurate for Hollywood without making it look really boring.
Right. I love that. The, like, yeah, because that it is depict. I mean, because what's interesting about that film, though, is that she starts as sort of like a con artist and then has an actual experience and then go ahead.
I was going to say, which surprisingly is how a lot of people find out they have the ability. They just are going about their own life. Not that they're all con artists, I should say, but, like, they're just going about their own life. And then all of a sudden they're able to see or sense spirits. Like, it's pretty common that people will tell you that they just woke up one day and they could do it.
I love that. I've been with you out and about in the world when you've, sort of, I actually don't know the proper terminology, like sensed ghosts, spirits, something. Do you have, like, a story of, like, I don't know, the most inconvenient or frustrating time that you've had, like, one of these experiences?
Oh my gosh, there's too many to count. There is one time I recall I was out to dinner with friends in LA, and I got up in the meal to go to the restroom, and in the women's bathroom was the spirit of a woman who had been murdered, like, in the 1980s. She wasn't trapped there or anything, but she mentally was staying near the place that she had passed away, hoping for help. And so I went back to dinner and I told my friends, oh, there's this spirit woman in the bathroom. I don't want to leave without helping her. And so my friends were super nice and decided, like, okay, we'll stay with you. We'll wait. That was, again, like, early in my days of working with spirits. You know, I've had the ability my whole life, but I ignored it for, like, 20 some years. So this was around the time that I decided to stop ignoring it and do something with it. So I went in and I was helping her, and she was giving me all this information about, you know, her family, where she lived, messages she wanted to get delivered to people. And eventually I got her to leave the bathroom. But I was so exhausted from it that I could not drive home, and I had driven us to dinner, so I had to give my keys to a friend. I sat in the back seat, and I literally passed out for about 30 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Didn't even realize that I was that exhausted. But, yeah, that was fairly inconvenient.
Yeah. That's amazing. I've never heard that story. All right, and then there is – it's funny. I'm like, definitely want to talk to you about – I will talk to you again about some later stuff because I think Lost in its later seasons kind of tries to go down this path again with a more maybe sincere and open-hearted approach than it does here.
Right.
And so that'll be interesting to talk about later on in this rewatch project. But before we go, like, I also, you know, I brought you on here because you have this firsthand knowledge of this, profession, but also, you know, you're one of my film and TV friends. You know a lot about this. I know that you, watched Lost on your lunch breaks, you know, leading up to the final series.
I did when I worked at Disney. Yep.
Guys, I'll watch Lost together. What, like, you know, up until this point in the series in season one, I don't know, what are your broad ideas of the show? What characters do you love? What do you love about Lost, that is already on display in the show?
You know, when I was doing the rewatches originally, way back when on my lunch breaks, I didn't even know what to expect. Like, I knew it was a show that people really enjoyed, but I didn't know why. And so when I started watching it, for me, it was more the what is going on. Like, every episode, you just don't really know what the backstory is, essentially. Like, you don't know why they crashed, why they survived, where they are, what's going on. So that kept me coming back. I mean, literally, we had like a flowchart diagram of every character in every situation trying to work out what happened. But I think the other thing that really makes it endearing is every single character that you're introduced to, and there are a lot of them, is a full person. Like, they have a backstory. They have their own, like, every story about them is fleshed out. And so, you know, there's nobody's really throwaway. And for that, it really makes you love a lot of people and it makes you hate a lot of people. And I know, like, when I rewatched this episode and they had to go to Sawyer for the manifest, I was like, oh, that guy. And I had this, like, cringiness because I remembered the first time I watched the show, I was like, oh, I hate that guy. But then I ended up loving that I hated him. And so it was very, like, mixed emotions, like, coming back to it and going, oh, yeah, these are those people that made up such a big part of my life before. So, he's the character I love to hate. Hurley is the character I love to love.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Can't help but love him.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. We have a lot of listeners who are watching for the first time who are like, I don't really understand why anyone likes Sawyer. And we're like, okay, just hold on.
Yeah.
We'll get there, I think. Maybe. Maybe. You don't, that's okay too. But
it's like Stockholm Syndrome, sort of. Like, you dislike him so much that you end up liking him because you just can't stand him.
And then I guess my last question, you and I had talked a little bit about this off air, when I first talked to you about coming on this episode, but, if there's a non-spoiler way that you can talk about, the ending of Lost or the latter sort of weirder seasons of Lost, and, you know, there's a lot of controversy around the ending and people feeling like, you know, it famously didn't stick the landing and stuff like that. Right. Do you have any sort of non-spoiler thoughts on people watching for the first time or people rewatching who felt like they were burned by the ending? Like, what are your thoughts on that, aspect of it these many years later?
So I remember when I watched the last season and got to the end, I was confused. Because by that point, like I said, we had a big flowchart spreadsheet of everything. So we thought we knew what was going on. And I didn't really have the disappointment. It was more like I just was still trying to understand the real, like, heart and soul of the story. And I think what, you know, the credit is given to the writers and producers of the show, that we're like 10 years later and we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, people will still talk about the ending of Lost, where they were and what their impressions were and all of that. And so, you know, for that, I think rewatching it as well is, when you know what's coming, you can see the buildup a little bit clearer. And so it actually makes it even more enjoyable. So I would say for anybody that's not seen it before, who's watching it for the first time, just go along for the ride and keep an open mind. And, you know, what you think is happening is probably not what's happening.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Yeah, I think it's, and I'm hopeful it's almost like healing for some people to come back to it. Maybe if you were angry about the ending the first time, to come back to it. So to be able to watch these first seasons, which were pretty universally beloved, and so to reconnect with what it was about the show that you really liked to begin with, and then you know, rewatching it without all the pressure of the zeitgeist around the ending, I'm hoping the ending will have a different mindset of viewing it this time around, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, you know, there's something to be said as well about the fact that when the show was created, while it did have an overall story arc that they had planned, there was a lot of pressure at the time because it was such a highly rated and highly loved production, to make, you know, the next episode bigger, better, more daring. And so, you know, the expectation of the viewers became so huge that I don't think at the time anything that they could have done would have been satisfactory. So in hindsight, now going back to it, having a little distance from it, definitely you can watch it and appreciate it for exactly what it was meant to be in the writer's eyes.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I am, I'm so thrilled that you came on to talk about this. It's all, you were like the perfect bolt of blue guest out of the blue. I was like, Amy, of course.
Right.
Come on and talk about this episode. If people want to hear like more of your thoughts, on the spirit realm or your work with there, where can people find more info about you?
Yeah, so I have my own website, amythemedium.com, and that's spelled A-I-M-E-E, because my mom wanted to be different when she named me. Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all Amy the Medium is my handle on all of them. And yeah, reach out to me there, and I'd be happy to chat with anybody.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And I will definitely be wanting to talk to you again in, like, I don't know, a couple of years. When we get to the later season.
I got you.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
And now's the time in the episode where we thank some of our small council Patreons. You can become one yourself at patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and then you get to hear your name. And we get to thank you like this. Thank you, Stephen Fushi, Angela Flunker, Christopher Holmquist, Alicia Gressla, Elliot Goldbaum, hey Elliot, Dharma Jess, Todd Bousset, Tay, Darth Fishius, excellent, just excellent, Logan Wagner, Kevin Mullaney, Carol Blaine, Monica Rickman, Sarah Boswell, Ruby Durham, Tanya Shrum, Dennis Ramirez, and Crystal Kirk. Thank you very much.
Dave, you'll be surprised to hear this, but I have a list of names as well, people that I would like to thank.
Shocked.
Let's begin with Josh Froschheiser, Rebels, Alyssa Scott, Ellen Rabin, Ryan Allwood, Quang Yu Liu. Okay, yeah, I think I did okay. Jual, Liz Major, Brian Morawski, Randy Blash, Craig Esther, Brittany Whimsy Riot, Sam Cohen, Sean, just Sean, Kate Whitney, Amber Vickers, Shosav Odaleg. Yeah, no, that's not right at all. I don't think that's right at all, but I tried it. Nathan Critchfield, Patricia Delaunay, and Tim Weissman. Thank you all very much.
I just want to say that Elliot, who is Dave's friend of like something like 20 years or whatever, joined our Slack Patreon, and one of the very first things he wrote in the chat was like, I've known Dave for several decades. Anyone want to hear some stories?
So double thanks to Elliot.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I want to thank Carrie King, Melissa Horsfall, Mariana Cotto. F, I swear I've nailed that one before.
We'll get it eventually.
Nate, Sarah Ellis, Robbie Rapace, Jose Cordova, Emily Ralph, Amy Gomez, Maggie Craddock, Laurel White, Chris Miracle, Brandy Mandato, Katie Truchon, Judy Wick, Cameron Valor, Erlen Holbeck, Julie Sorrells, Delane Mitchell, and Amy Calhoun. Thank you guys so much, and I want to send an extra thanks to Dave for that, like, Holmqvist reading, which is very Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Anyway, thank you all very much.
Boom! Crash! Storm noises! Goes on crashing trees at the monster set.
Pew, pew, yeah, that, pew, that one's good, pew, too.
Yeah, oh yeah, pew pews are important.
We're in the storm, where I don't have to talk about there not being numbers.
You're like numerical-based story.
You know, if there's a lot of numbers show up, that'll be important.
There's some numerical-based stories coming up, but three is not one of them.
I don't know what you call them.
Pay attention to all the numbers except for three.
Yeah.
All right,
I'm
gonna kick this off with an email that's gonna lead into our favorite storm subject. Okay, you ready?
Okay.
This email's from Grant, who wrote in before, and I think I've done a better job of condensing what is a beautiful, long, long, long email from Grant. Dave, Neil, and Joanna, I continue to enjoy your work transforming to a Lost podcast, but take issue with Dave's assertion that Locke is a villain due to some of his actions at the beginning of the series. While his moral standing tends to be somewhere on a sliding scale, the further into the show we go, I want to suggest that perhaps Locke is merely a different type of protagonist than our typical hero or villain tropes, and this type of protagonist gains some traction in pop culture in the years immediately preceding Lost. Want to talk about leather cuffs. Here we go. Locke as a transgressive hero. Transgressive fiction was a term I learned about from Chuck Palahniuk when I started reading his books around 1999, when his most well-known book, Fight Club, became a movie. Let's get a few definitions out of the way. Transgressive fiction is a genre of literature which focuses on characters who feel confined by the norms and expectations of society and who break free from those confines in unusual or illicit ways. John Locke's backstory is of someone bound to what he perceives as a dull existence as a corporate drone. He's tethered to a dialysis machine. He tries to quell his overwhelming loneliness by paying phone sex operators. His father conned him out of a kidney. He attended support groups for anger management. His fiance left him because he couldn't overcome his relationship with his dad, who ended up throwing him from an 80-story window, paralyzing him. Prior to the island, Locke is trapped in a bleak existence of consumerism and paralysis, confined to his terrible job and his wheelchair. He yearns to escape, to become one with the earth through a spiritual journey of walkabout, which will provide purpose and destiny. I also mentioned Locke's backstory because I want to note elements shared with early Palahniuk stories, support groups, corporate drones, unhealthy and somewhat transgressive coping strategies for loneliness, daddy issues, all the best cowboys have them, and of course, an all-important plane crash. Locke's relationship with Boone in Hearts and Minds is particularly interesting because he acts as an antagonist to gain Boone's loyalty. Think of the scene in Fight Club where Tyler Durden burns his kiss into the narrator's hand. He inflicts pain to gain loyalty. The island gives Boone a vision, as Locke ties him up and leaves him in the jungle. The result of each scene, the one in Fight Club and the one in Hearts and Minds, is letting go. And then he says a lot of great stuff that I can't read because this is very long, beautiful email. But he mentions Locke's most villainous acts, and I would kind of agree with them, which is his treatment of Boone, using Sawyer to kill his own dad. That happens later. Killing Naomi by throwing a knife in her back. Those are sort of like Locke's worst things that he does. But then he lists a few of Locke's heroic things that he does, like the fact that Locke
much later on in the series, people may not remember this, but Locke moves the donkey wheel, gets off the island. He'll have to give up the island, the thing he loves the most, to bring back the Oceania 66, which he knows will result in his death. That's specifically Jesus-y moment. And then Grant's evidence that the show sees Locke as a hero is that in season 6, he is in the sideways world afterlife with the 815 survivors, not with the island purgatory spirits like Michael. In the end, Locke and Jack and the other A15 survivors find peace together. Their stories all resolve, and their souls, for lack of a better term, are able to move on as a church where they dissolve into light. So this idea that there's evidence on the show that we're not meant to see Locke as a villain, but rather a lot of our other characters, a hero, maybe not a typical one, who stumbles several times along the way. Dave, do you want to respond to Grant's email?
I like it. I read the full one because it popped up on my alert and I just saw the first two lines and ended with, but I want to take issue with Dave's opinion of Locke. I'm like, all right, here we go. Stop what I'm doing. Maybe the better, I think that it definitely holds for the first season, which is the one that I've rewatched the most. Applying it to the whole show does get more difficult for, I think, all the reasons the email talks about. It might be more helpful to, instead of doing Locke villainy check-in, just to check in to see if there is a villain.
Okay.
And then if not, who gets the closest to, I think, acting on the negative side of the island's intentions. Because this episode, obviously, to, ship things a little bit more to Ethan, really only has a questionable look from Locke when he learns that they're not alone on the island. And he does, seem surprised by it. And then I think next episode, he goes on the search for Claire and Charlie because he feels bad for having not realized what Ethan was. So I think now, specifically to establish the others, we need some more othering to shift us away from Locke. And then, yes, as we get further into different seasons, he definitely the self-sacrifice and the being at the church heaven at the end definitely makes it all hard to square with a hard villain. But I also seem to remember a lot of wandering around in the jungle to counterpoints where I'm not exactly sure if he's the actor that he needs to be a full hero. I like the idea of transgressive heroes because I like the idea of, referencing literary tropes that Lost definitely has on its mind. It's just whether or not they're able to successfully be that or whether it's that in order to subvert it later on, I think is yet to be seen. But I love these emails, even though they're kind of slowly chipping away at my argument. But I'm going to hold it for as long as I can.
Do you have any thoughts here, Neil?
So we're saying that Locke's real name is Robert Paulson.
Sure.
Well, okay.
That's a Fight Club reference for the people who didn't see the 1999 movie or read the book.
Well, this idea, I never thought of John Locke in his box factory existence as a sort of Ed Norton from Fight Club figure. I mean, Fight Club is a problematic story or one that, what were we talking about? Oh, we were talking about, once again, we were talking about Watchmen. How some characters in the comic book Watchmen were sort of mistakenly hero worshipped by people when the author, that was not the authorial intent. I think that's true of Fight Club too, that Fight Club became this manifesto for certain angry young men when that's not really what the author was going for. Can I tell my weird Chuck Palahniuk story right now?
Sure.
Are there normal Chuck Palahniuk stories?
Maybe not. But he, I used to work in various bookstores, and he, in one bookstore that I worked in, he, I forget why, but he wound up in correspondence with one of our booksellers. He would send letters to the bookstore addressed to this person. This person, I think, helped him with a special order or something like that. Anyway, he would just send
little packages of like weird shit. So occasionally we would just get little packages of weird shit from Chuck Palahniuk, and it would be like weird little baby dolls, like whatever it was. It was like some creepy serial killer stuff.
He was Jared Leto yes. Jokering.
No, but it wasn't like a fetal pig or whatever. It wasn't that creepy. It was just like, it was like borderline.
Well, yeah, but he's also not playing the Joker, so I feel it's equally as creepy. Like, the Jared Leto one's just like, dude, what are you doing? And this is, I feel like, the same level of just like, ugh, this is not the way that you show people affection. Anyway, having read a lot of his books, that does not surprise me.
Yeah.
Elsewhere in this episode, I want to return to Malkin, who ends up telling Echo later on that he's like a fraud, which also feels like, if I was reading Lostpedia and its linked sources correctly, it also seems like it wasn't always the case that they sort of had Malkin as like a side character who could pop up post-Echo again, and it just sort of never did. And so because of that, he, whether or not he's psychic and whether or not he interfered, or, you know, if there was another couple in Los Angeles, all sorts of sort of bleeds into the...
Are Jack and Kate the couple in Los Angeles? I mean, like, this is the weird thing about the whole Raised by Another concept is, like, if Malkin is a fraud, which he says he is, and the showrunner said he was later, even though the script page from this episode, like, indicates that he knew exactly what he was doing, maneuvering her on that flight, which makes me feel like that feels like a very Jacob thing to, you know what I mean? Like, there's all this, like, maneuvering to get people into position. So how do you get Claire on that flight to get to the island and stuff like that?
Well, showing a scene that Jacob touched Malkin would have been, that would have wrapped that right up. It could have been like, oh, magic.
Got it. But, so if he's a fraud, but like his alarm seemed very real. Like, why, what would be his motivation for that alarm and all of the things that he was doing if he were a fraud? Right.
And, you like, know, how irresponsible is it to then give a woman $6,000 and put her on a plane to, like, maybe a couple, or to be an adoption agent just because you know you're a fraud and you have this feeling? Yeah, it seems like a bridge too far.
Yeah, so I feel like this is something that they kind of retcon, because they're like, we don't really have an answer for Malkin and we're not really going to go there, and we've kind of written Emily off the show a little bit in later season, so we're just not going to deal with it. But then it ties back into this whole, a strong part of the plot of the later seasons is Kate's guilt over raising Aaron. This idea that Aaron can't be raised by another, can't be raised by Kate, needs to be raised by Claire. That is a strong, like, part of later Lost. And so it's sort of connected to this episode and sort of not at the same time. It's very confusing because it's not like, because he says in this episode, right, like, Aaron's going to need your goodness in order to, like, sort of be okay. But, like, Kate is being a perfectly, like, competent mother, you know? Like, she's not being an evil mother to Aaron. And, like, Claire is banana pants at the point when, like, Kate goes back to get her. So, like, you know, I don't know. I feel, I guess this whole thing, because, like, feels messy to me.
There's a couple people who imply that Walt's special, and then, like, the show sort of puts its foot down on that. But then I think Malkin's the only person who really, like, implies that Aaron could be special. Otherwise, he's special because he was born on the island and because, you know, Ghost Dad wants to like, rope in Claire. But I don't think we have, unless I'm misremembering, any indication that when they do get back, when the Oceanic Six get back, that Aaron is, like, psychic in any sort of way or needs to be on the island.
Oh, we don't
see... It's more than he needs to be with Claire.
We don't see him, like, cause any birds to fly into windows, that's for sure.
Right.
So he's got some an edge on Walt in that regard. Yeah, no, I mean, like, I think... I love that storyline later, and I don't... Maybe we don't need to spend too much time about that, but I like that as, like, the reason why would anyone go back
for Jack, it's because he believes he's like burdened by some destiny now because of Locke. For Sun, it's the slim hope that Jin might be alive. And then for Kate, it's this guilt over taking Aaron. But she didn't take him. I don't know. It's interesting, but it's all, but that whole like raised by another is a phrase that I think of all the time when I think about Lost. But I don't think the Mulkin thread stretches all the way through the series in a really, satisfying way. This is an unsatisfying thread, for me. Neil, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, I agree. And I think it's one of those things where you can kind of see that they had more of an idea. The idea that we're seeing here, where Claire it was sort of set up by Mulkin or Destiny or whatever to be on that plane, it changes later, I guess, is the best. Like, the idea behind it, they just sort of give up on that idea, which this happens from time to time with Lost.
Sure.
So this won't be the first one that we see where they just sort of come up with an interesting idea, put it in the backstory, and then bail on it. My question to you guys is, at this point, did the show know that Claire and Jack were related? At this point.
Well, they mentioned her daddy abandonment issues.
Sure.
I'm going to say at this point, the show doesn't even know if Claire's second dream actually happened or not. Like, I know that the injections don't come up again for, like, at least a full season.
Like, that's true.
I think there are a lot of open doors. Like, but no, I don't think they know specifically, because I think otherwise there'd be a lot more hand tipping in the next episode with a Claire and Jack episode being so close together. But we're so consumed next week with, you know, Jack not letting people die and what happened between him and Christian that, no, I don't think the show knows yet. That's a guess.
When do we find out? Is it season three? This is what Lostpedia is trying to tell me.
That sounds right.
Lostpedia is saying that, like, they begin to argue, which led to the revolution, that he, Christian Shepherd, was Claire's father. No, I feel like we find it out in an episode where we see Christian stuff.
There's an Ana Lucia.
That's what it is. The Ana Lucia episode. Because she's bodyguarding.
It's not connected to Claire.
Well, she's bodyguarding Christian, and Christian goes to Claire's mom's house or his aunt's, whatever, some blonde Australian lady. He's like, well, my daughter. And she's like, get out of here. You're drunk. Or whatever. so that's when we find out.
Get out of here.
Crikey. So that's season two, right? So
She's got a nice artist boyfriend.
Is Joanna an Australian? She is not, so.
All right. So I think we have, you know, we're going to have a lot more to talk about with the others and everything and the pregnancy. Moving forward, is there anything else pegged specifically to Raised by Another we need to cover this week?
I don't...
The resounding silence of an episode well covered. That was your chance to bring up peanut butter for a third time, Joanna.
I'll just say this. We've gotten a lot of emails and tweets and Slack messages that I really need to give natural peanut butter another chance. A lot of tips on how to store it upside down, in the fridge, all this sort of stuff. Guys, it's not happening. I'm never doing it.
Have we settled the crunchy versus smooth debate?
There's no settling that. That's a matter of taste, but it's smooth, obviously, so it's fine.
I didn't know we were just doing wrong answers.
This has never come up before. Otherwise, this would have happened.
So you know this was unplanned.
All right, so before we go off podcast and hash this out in the Thunderdome, where could people find more of your work until the next time we talk? Mr. Neil Miller.
Oh, you know, you can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, also on Twitter, @rejects, and don't forget all of the @Storm podcast places you can find us, including our email, hosts@stormpodcast.com.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me at vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter @JoeWroteThis.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter @DA7E. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. If you didn't get enough Spider-Man Far From Home in this feed earlier I am also on Thrillist.com doing some splaining / speculating. And as per usual, I'm right here, right now, in your ears, telling you, begging you, please don't fall down.